reporters with a White House or presidential beat in 2019 have to be ever vigilant. Both President Trump and the modern news cycle rarely seem to pause. Josh Dossie covers the White House for The Washington Post, and last week he came to the University of Arkansas campus to deliver the 2019 Roy Reed Lecture. Before his evening address, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Just days before he had been named as the winner of the Merriman Smith Memorial Award for Excellence in Presidential News Coverage under deadline pressure. This came from the White House Correspondents Association and was related to his coverage of a story regarding a remark made by President Trump inside the White House. That's one of the subjects we covered during our conversation. And this was on the story when the president referred to countries of possible immigrants as, well, we'll say it, S-hole countries.
Correct. Here. That's a good way to say it.
Which, so you hear about this, you have a deadline, you've got to confirm this because this isn't something you just report.
Right. It's not something that you just report on a whim.
So are you on your cell phone? Are you texting? Are you getting multiple?
Sure.
You got to find out who's in the room.
That day, the tip came to me within 45 minutes of a meeting. Someone who emerged from the White House said to me, he said something very offensive about countries, about immigrant countries. And, you know, the first thought was, wow, if that's true, that's a big story. And we often, as reporters, you know this, you get a hot tip and you go, if true, that's a big story. But what if it's not true, right? So then, you know, I spent 2 or 3 hours fitfully calling other folks that I knew were either in the meeting or had been briefed on the meeting to try and get a confirming source. And right when I basically thought I had it, another reporter, Julie Davis of the New York Times, called one of my sources and asked him to confirm it for her for a second source. And I told our editors at that point, I said, we've got to get this online or we're gonna lose this story. And what we did was, you know, we posted a quick 6-paragraph story and then build it out further as the day went on with context and reactions and quotes. And, you know, there's a really aggressive competitive story. There's a delicate line between, you know, being careful and getting it right, which is obviously the first and the utmost priority, but also losing. You know, you often have to make these decisions in a several seconds, several minutes, you know, less than an hour of what do we know and what can we publish. And
do you have a bottle of Pepto-Bismol nearby at all times? That sounds nerve-wracking.
It's totally nerve-wracking. It's invigorating. It's a part of a job that I love. I mean, if you're in this business and you don't love breaking news, then you should do something else because it's a bread and butter of what we do. But of course it's nerve-wracking. When you post a story and, you know, for an hour or two, it's everyone on television and Twitter's talking about it and another outlet hasn't matched it, you go, is there a chance some small fiber in me, 1%, that I could have gotten the story wrong and it's going to end my career? I mean, you know, the Post, like the Wall Street Journal and Politico, other places I work, have checks and balances where, you know, you have anonymous sources, but your editors know who your anonymous sources are. You tell them. You have to ask people how they know information. I mean, there are obviously processes in place to keep big mistakes from happening, but they still occasionally happen to people. And it's gut-wrenching, needless to say. I think the Pepto-Bismol was right.
What's a conversation like if you're calling a source perhaps who was in the room at the time when that phrase was used and would rather not talk to you about it? Is it a brief conversation between you and that potential source or?
You negotiate, you beg, you cajole, you cry, you do whatever it takes to try to get people to give you info in those situations. I mean, you know, a lot of phone conversations between, you know, reporters, myself included, and White House officials begin with someone stonewalling you, and then you, you know, try to get them to tell you 10% of it, and then you poke, well, was it this? It couldn't have been this, was it? And then you start trying to rule out other possibilities of what it couldn't have been, and then, okay, I know you heard that. Someone else told me that. You have to confirm this for me. I don't want to. No, you have to. I mean, there's these, you know, agonizing, kind of, you know, frustrating conversations that are that are really fun, I'd say. I mean, I sound like a cynical, crazy person saying that, but they're really fun. It's fun to have these conversations. I mean, it's part of a job that I love. And, you know, you just – you call enough people till someone feels sorry for you or likes you enough or does whatever, and they confirm something for you, and then you print it.
So many of the stories that you cover now, being a White House reporter, they're not just in D.C. They might be in El Paso or some other right. place in the country or the world. What is your workday like? Are you on your phone in the office? Are you at the White House most of the time? Or
depends on the day. You know, I travel a good bit with the president. I'm on probably every third or fourth trip. I was recently in Hanoi with him at the North Korea summit. I go with him to Florida for his weekends. I've been with him to the border recently. You know, if there are press briefings, sometimes I'm there. I'm usually at the White House at least twice a week for meetings with administration officials, you know, coffees off campus, meeting with someone on campus. But a lot of my day is spent sitting behind a computer screen, two computer screens actually, and working the phones. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a scene of like in people's minds, they probably think covering the White House is more glamorous than it is. I mean, there's certainly glamorous days like flying on Air Force One or being in an Osprey, you know, flying over the country or, you know, having a one-on-one interview with the president. Those are certainly, you know, all happen and they're, you know, kind of moments that you kind of plug in your memory and you know they're special and that you got to have those experiences. But, you know, 90% of a job is just, you know, emailing and texting and calling and meeting people for coffees and, you know, doing the grunt work that you have to do to get good stories.
You are a member of a professional group that has been called Enemy of the People by the very person you cover. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's ever called you specifically an enemy.
Not by name. He's referred to my outlet as that, I believe, but not by name.
That is an odd relationship.
I mean, I don't know what you want me to say to that. I agree. It's an odd relationship. I mean, we have not had another president, Republican or Democrat, in the 40, 50 years of our country who have called the press the enemy of the people. It's a fact. You know, politicians of all parties and stripes gripe about their press coverage. Some do it more publicly than others. No politician loves the press corps that follows them around and writes negative stories about them and scrutinizes them and investigates them. But the level of rhetoric that this president's had towards the press is different than any other president. Just a fact.
Have you had any dealings with members of the public who dislike or distrust or, you know, hurl insults?
All the time. I get reader emails that are very negative, some including threats, every single day.
Every single day.
If you looked at my Twitter feed, you would see some vitriolic comments. You know, you would see, you know, sometimes we'll get random phone calls where you answer and someone just diatribes about how, you know, goes on a diatribe about how terrible you are and how you're ruining the country. Sure. Now, on the flip side, you also get a lot of folks who, you know, see you on the street and say thank you for what you do. And you get a lot of positive comments and a lot of emails, you know, that are praiseworthy and a lot of tweets that are praiseworthy. But There's a level of vitriol that I've never had as a reporter covering Christie or de Blasio and Trump. This is far different than anything else I've ever experienced, this level of hate.
What kind of quick study do you have to be, because the White House beat can cover everything from immigration to nuclear proliferation to, you know, Jesse Smollett?
Right. That's a good question. You know, you have to have knowledge on things kind of an inch deep and a mile wide, so to speak. You know, one day you're in Hanoi writing about nuclear talks, and next week you're writing about his plans at the border, and you're writing about a healthcare proposition. You know, you have to be a quick study and read a lot. You know, one of the great benefits of being at a place like the Washington Post is that, you know, I have colleagues who cover healthcare and cover the State Department who can quickly brief me if I say, listen, I have to write a story in 3 hours on this. Can you give me a lay of the land on where things are? And I have a lot of great colleagues who will do that. But you have to just kind of adapt on your feet and move with the punches. This is a president who you've seen many times can make news on 4, 5, 6 topics in a day. And sometimes you have to just kind of bounce like a ball and figure out all of them as best you can. And some days we do it better than others.
You grew up in Columbia, South Carolina, is that right?
Near Columbia, yeah.
Columbia. Which is an area kind of like Northwest Arkansas,
sure,
as far as population, college town.
Yeah.
Is there still for you, because you're a young man in the reporting circles, for sure. I mean, is there still a sense of awe for you when you walk into the White House? I mean, you're walking into the White House. Or is that just where you work?
Both. I mean, when you go there all the time, there are days where, you know, it's raining or you're tired or you're frustrated and it just feels like work. In fact, it feels like miserable work sometimes, not just work. And then there are days when you're walking down the driveway and, you know, it's sunny and it's 70 degrees and you have your White House badge on and you certainly go, this is pretty neat. You know, I cover the White House. I get to work in the White House. So some days it feels like work. Some days it feels, you know, as awe-inspiring as you'd say. I'd say the longer you do it, the more, frankly, it feels like work. It feels, you know, there's still days that are very awe-inspiring. Now, there are other moments, right? You know, I think getting on Air Force One is awe-inspiring every time I do it. I've flown on Air Force One probably 30 times now, and every time I get on, I'm like, this is pretty cool. This is pretty freaking cool. You know, there are times when you're on a foreign travel with him and you're, you know, in the room where he's talking with Kim Jong-un and you're watching from 50 feet away or 30 feet away. You know, that's surreal. And then there are days where, you know, you're just sitting there and hours and hours and hours of outside of his golf course, waiting for him to finish 18 holes of golf, sitting in a van, and that feels like work. So it depends on what you're doing, right?
This is such an unusual presidency, like none we've had before. You mentioned attacks on a dead U.S. senator who's considered a war hero, these sorts of things. What kind of – how have you developed whether, oh, did this really happen or this has to be BS?
In what way?
Well, when you first hear something like – perhaps a story or a tip.
You chase everything. I mean, there's nothing that anyone tells me, short of something that I saw with my own eyes that would contradict it, that I don't at least make calls on. I mean, if someone has a tip, you chase it. Now, 2.5 years in, I think we've gotten better as a press corps at figuring out, you know, who in the White House usually tells more of a truth than others. So if someone who calls me who tends to lie to me repeatedly or has lied to me in the past with some sort of hot tip or gossip, I'm less likely to drop everything and chase it. You know, I have a number of sources who I think are pretty close to honest brokers. And if they call and say, this happened today at work, then I will drop everything and chase it. It's kind of the rule of percentages. So,
and I guess you just have to keep in mind that everyone has an agenda.
Sure, of course. Everyone has an agenda. Some people have more of an outward agenda than others. Some people have more of a discernible agenda than others. There's certainly conversations when people tell you things with editors. Why are they telling us this? You know, sometimes it's crystal clear. You know, they hate that person and they want a bad story. Sometimes they lost a policy fight. They were pushing for, let's say, a more or less rigorous immigration policy, and the president went the other way, and they're trying to bludgeon someone who got their way. Sometimes, even in this White House, sometimes they're just honest people. I mean, I have a few sources who I feel give me as close to the truth as they see it, and we even acknowledge our own faults at times. But it depends on the person. I mean, most sources have agendas. I mean, most sources have agendas. And this White House, covering Bill de Blasio, covering Chris Christie, if someone's going to talk to a reporter, they tend to want something out of it, a certain kind of story to hurt their enemy, to get something out about a political opponent, you know.
Finally, how often do you think about your responsibility as that conduit between the news that's happening and those of us that read the stories under your byline?
Well, you think every day that, you know, I feel I want nothing underneath my name that's wrong. I mean, in 2.5 years on this beat. Knock on wood. How much wood do you have in your office here? Knock on wood.
That's a wood-like substance.
You know, I've not had a substantive correction. I mean, I've misspelled a name or gotten a number wrong, and no correction's fun, but not a substantive correction that undercut the thrust of an entire story. I mean, all of us who do this, I mean, you lose sleep at night when you work on a big story and, you know, it's going to publish the next day and you're afraid there could be something wrong in it or an opponent could come after you. If you stop living in, like, fear of having a correction, you will, you know, it's kind of – it's a bad way to live, right? I mean, you want to live in fear of having corrections. So I think a lot about, you know, am I giving readers an accurate, to the best of my ability – sense of what's happening in the White House that day.
And then getting enough of it, right? Not necessarily not getting something wrong, but just making sure you've gotten as much of the stories you can get in there.
Yeah. I mean, you gather your acorns while you may, so to speak. I mean, they, you know, you. I have a post-it note on my desk that says, you know, use the phone. And it's just a reminder for me, you know, I'm sitting at my computer. Stop looking at Twitter. Stop responding to needless emails. Stop gossiping with colleagues and, like, pick up the phone and do reporting. And, you know, the best days are, like, when you report all day and you figure out something really good and you get to put it in the paper. And there's always that lingering fear, right, that, you know, newspapering is a daily business. Online is even shorter than that, and you have to publish a lot. And, you know, you always fear, do I really know the whole story? You know, particularly in this White House, that kind of feels like a hall of mirrors sometimes with people giving different accounts. I mean, you kind of triangulate and you use your best instincts and do as much as you can and you write it and you hope that you get it right. I mean, I say to critics of the media, you know, sometimes particularly places I've worked, I mean, I wish that the average person could come and watch what we do in a day. I mean, they would certainly – there would be parts of it that maybe they thought – you know, where they wouldn't do it the same way or maybe, you know, whatever. But I wish people could see how the newspapers put out every day, the level of editing things go through, how many colleagues are involved, how much questioning of our sources goes on, like the drive to actually get it right. It's not that we don't make mistakes. It's not that our coverage decisions sometimes aren't right. It's not that all of those things are true. Newspapers are not perfect. News organizations are not perfect. But there's a good faith, you know, really robust effort every single day at places like the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal to get it as right as we can, right? And, I mean, it kind of makes you proud to work there. And the people that hate us and think we're just, you know, spewers of fake news bile, I would just sometimes say, come watch what we do. I mean, it's kind of frustrating in that way.
First thing you do when you wake up, last thing before you go to bed and go to sleep, the phone's been off since we started this conversation. When it's over, you're going to have to check?
Immediately.
All right. Well, we won't keep you any longer. Josh, thanks you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Josh Stassi covers the White House and President Trump for the Washington Post. He was on the University of Arkansas campus last week to deliver the 2019 Roy Reed Lecture as part of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media's annual Journalism Days observation. And this is Ozarks at Large.